So I'm Blake Pearson. I'm a neurosurgeon at Brookwood. I practice with Norwood Clinic. I've been in practice since 2010. I did my residency at UAB. And I treat brain problems and back problems and peripheral nerve problems. Today we're going to talk about low back pain. I know some of you probably suffer from low back pain and neck pain. If you have questions about neck pain, I'll be glad to answer those at the end as well. If you have questions about brain tumors, I can answer those as well. But the focus of this topic is really the low back. Back pain is an important issue. It affects a huge number of people. 90% of people have back pain at some point in their lifetime. It's number one cause of missing work. 82 million workdays are lost a year because of low back pain. It is the number five overall complaint for general practitioners. So again, huge numbers of people are presenting to medical care because they have low back problems. And it's a huge societal cost because lots of people end up on disability. They can no longer work because they have back pain. I'd like to start with some basic anatomy, just so we all understand what we're talking about with regards to the low back. The low back is made up of five lumbar vertebrae and the sacrum. The numbering, if you've ever had an MRI, they spit out a whole bunch of L and 5 and 3 and S, and the question about what the numbers mean, we number based on the vertebra itself, so the bone is numbered. The disc space between is labeled with the two numbers, so if the L2-3 disc space is between the L2 vertebra and the L3 vertebra. The nerves are also numbered. They go along with the bone they're associated with. And that's really, it's semantics, but it's important if you are talking to a physician to have at least some understanding of that to be able to communicate what's happened to you in the past. I have patients all the time who come in and tell me that their L4 disc was operated on, and it's very difficult to interpret what they're trying to say because they don't know what has happened to them in the past. I have to end up looking at the MRI and guessing where they had their operation before. A lot of times I can see it, but sometimes it's very difficult. The disc itself, which is a source of a lot of trouble, is made up of two components. There's a hard outer ring called the annulus, and then there's a soft, gooey center. The soft, gooey center is what gives us our padding. It's our cushion, our shock absorber. And the hard outer ring is responsible for holding that in place and some structural support. That's one of the joints at each level in the spine. There are actually three joints at each level. There's that disc, and then there are the facet joints that are in the back. The facet joints allow the spine to move some, but not too much. And then, of course, in the center of the spine, surrounded by bone, there's the spinal canal, which houses our nerve roots. And in the low back, it is nerve roots. The spinal cord actually ends way up here at the top. So generally, when we're talking about low back difficulty and difficulty with the nerves in the low back, we're not talking about the spinal cord. That's important because it means it's a less dangerous area. sending people for blocks, I'm much, much more likely to send somebody for a block in the low back than the block in the neck. And that's because it's just much safer. If you end up with a problem, if they put the needle in a little too far for a block in the low back, it's not going to cause a huge issue. If they put the needle in a little too far in the neck, it can cause paralysis. And the anesthesia doctors who do blocks are very, very good, but at the same time, I have seen people who had trouble with injections in the neck, and it's just much safer in the low back. There are complex muscular connections in the back. These big pieces of bone that stick out to the side and stick out to the back are where the muscles connect. And this is important because there are thousands of muscular connections within the back. All the bones are connected to each other. There are lots of ligaments. And the muscles themselves are actually a huge factor in back pain. It's the number one reason for somebody to have back pain actually involves the muscles themselves. So where does back pain come from? There are several sources of back pain. I have them kind of nicely divided up here as if all of these exist in a vacuum. Back pain doesn't exist in a vacuum, and the majority of people who have back pain are suffering from some combination of these. Some are, of course, more common than others, some will actually lead to others. When talking about muscular low back pain, this is the most common reason for acute pain. If somebody says that they threw out their back, or they are having back pain all of a sudden that they didn't have, most likely it's actually coming from the muscular connections in the back, and they have a muscle strain or a muscle spasm or a ligamentous strain or sprain. Usually there is something that they did. They know, I picked up that box, I shouldn't have moved that box, but I did it, and now I can barely move around. It's excruciatingly painful. The pain tends to be in the back, usually a little bit off to one side. That people can usually say, it hurts more on the right than it does on the left. There does not tend to be pain that goes down into the leg. Now, where the leg starts is a little bit of a difficult question. Sometimes the pain will go down into the buttock. If we think about those muscular connections, the muscles do come from the back all the way down into the buttocks, and it doesn't stop right where the low back crease, right where your belt ends. When talking about pain going down to the leg, we usually use the knee as the upper limit of saying you do or don't have leg pain. There is some variability in that, of course, but with muscular pain, it's not going to go all the way down into your foot the vast majority of the time. Most people will have some focal tenderness, so if you press on the back, they'll have a sore spot, these people have a very hard time moving. The good news about this very, very common source of back pain is it goes away. It usually lasts 2 to 6 weeks. If you look at the textbooks, a lot of them will say 2 to 4 weeks. In my experience, that's way too short-lived. Back pain from a muscle spasm can actually last a couple of months, and people will tell me all the time that, you know, they really didn't get back to feeling like themselves and having confidence in their back for about 3 or 4 months after they have a back strain. Well, if you have a back strain, what do we do about it? What's the right thing to do if you move that planner and now you can hardly roll out of bed? The best medicines for this are anti-inflammatory medications. You can get them over the counter. It's Advil, it's Aleve, so ibuprofen or naproxen. There are some prescription ones that can also be prescribed that are either better for your stomach if you have gastrointestinal problems, or are a little bit stronger if you just need a little bit more oomph than the ibuprofen is going to give you. Muscle relaxers are, of course, a good treatment option here. Because the problem will get better with stretching, traction tends to help, and physical therapists and chiropractors have a huge role to play here. Chiropractic care takes care of about 60% of back trouble. They can make it go away. Now, of course, this kind of problem is going to go away on its own, but they can help speed your recovery. Physical therapists are the same way. There are lots of things that they can use. They can use a TENS unit, they can use ultrasound, heat, massage. They do traction as well, stretching exercises for your back. All of these are very, very important. And with a muscle strain, it will go away. You do actually need to rest in a situation like this. I say for now because part of the prevention of something like this happening is staying active and getting into a regular physical activity program. So the most common reason for chronic low back pain, and this is pain that stays in the back, is degenerative arthritis. This is something that happens to everybody as we age, and it does tend to have a gradual onset. That doesn't mean that you won't have sudden flares. It just means that the sudden flares will get worse as we get older. It's like the arthritis that you get in your knees or your shoulders or your hands. It's going to bother you. Sometimes people say the weather is associated with it. I see that all the time. It is a gradual onset. The pain tends to be associated with the back, and it's central. There is not usually focal tenderness. So if I press on your back, you don't usually hurt with this. And the important thing to know about this is, while this is not usually something that requires urgent treatment, the advancing of the degenerative change, so the worsening arthritis, does usually cause gradual worsening of symptoms. And this is the problem that can lead to lots of other things coming down the road, such as instability or nerve compression, the weakness. This does get people into my office, and even if it's just degenerative change, a lot of times I say, you know, we're going to treat this conservatively, but you're going to be back. How do we treat this conservatively? The number one thing that has to happen is smokers must stop smoking. People who smoke don't heal very well, and we're constantly experiencing little micro injuries to our bones and joints. And if you're not healing those well, then the body forms arthritis. So if you're smoking, you will form arthritis. My estimation, and this is an estimation, is about 4 times faster than somebody who doesn't smoke. Does this mean you won't get arthritis if you don't smoke? No, of course not. You will just form it much faster. I can look at people's x-rays and in general tell whether or not they are a smoker by looking at their bone quality and the quality of their joints. I'm not always right with regards to telling that, but it's very, very important. If you're a smoker and you have any type of back pain, you must quit smoking, because you're just setting yourself up for a life of misery if you smoke. The anti-inflammatories, again, are key for this. Regular exercise, keeping yourself in good physical shape, training your body to manage pain. That's actually one of the best ways to deal with chronic pain. We know that people who exercise on a regular basis experience less pain through their lifetime. There's additional benefits with the exercise. Your back is carrying you around. If there's more of you, your back is doing more work. So weight loss will always help with the low back difficulty. If you get in a bad way, physical therapy and chiropractic management can keep you away from my knife for a very long time. Again, traction helps with this. It's the same as weight loss. What traction does, and this is, I'm talking about an inversion table here, or going to a chiropractor and they put you on the rack, the thing that stretches you out for disc decompression therapy. It's just a fancy form of traction. And what they're doing is they're offloading the spine. You're offloading the spine. You're stretching things out rather than compressing them, and it does make people feel significantly better. With straight back pain for degenerative disc disease specifically, not something that is going down the legs, surgery is generally a last resort. It doesn't work very well just for back pain. If the pain's going down your leg, that's a completely different matter, but pain in the back only gets better about 60% of the time if I do a surgery on your back. And it's a big surgery. It's a fusion operation. So if it's me and I have degenerative change in my back that is causing back pain, I try and stay as far away from surgery as possible, just because I know it doesn't work very well. Now, if you get to the point where you cannot function at all, then it does become an option. Usually for me, it's when somebody is crawling into my office saying, "My life is almost not worth living because of my back pain." That's when we start talking about an operation for back pain for degenerative disc disease. All right, that brings us to the point about narcotics. You notice narcotic pain medicine was not on that last slide. Narcotics are horrible for degenerative changes in the back. What happens is narcotics have their place in the treatment of pain. Narcotics should be used for the treatment of a pain that we expect to go away. If we don't expect the pain to go away, the narcotics are counterproductive. And I'm talking about Lortab and Percocet and Norco and oxycodone, hydrocodone, the fentanyl patches. If the pain is not expected to go away, what happens is your body gets used to that medicine being around very, very quickly, and it recalibrates its pain control system. It's like the opposite of doing exercise and teaching your body how to manage pain. You're unteaching your body how to manage pain, and in the long run, you will actually end up with significantly more pain than you had if you didn't ever take narcotics. So I always advise my patients, take as little as possible. And usually, if it gets to the point where they're having to take narcotics, we do need to have at least a little discussion about whether surgery would be indicated. But just in general, you really want to stay away from it as much as possible. Fractures, of course, cause back pain. There are really two varieties. There are fractures that are traumatic. That's usually a car accident or falling off a balcony or falling down the stairs. So you experience some major loading force, so something that squished the spine or twisted the spine to break a healthy bone. And then there are pathologic fractures. That happens to not healthy bones. That comes from tumors or osteoporosis or something that has weakened the intrinsic structure of the bone. Either way, of course, the pain is sudden onset. People know what they did with this. Sometimes with the osteoporotic bone, I had a lady who broke her back fluffing her pillow. She leaned over to fluff her pillow, and it was too much, and she had a sudden onset of pain. She came into the emergency room and had a fracture of one of her thoracic vertebrae. It is a stabbing pain, hurts to move, hurts to stand up. Anything that presses down on the spine, so sitting or standing, hurts much, much more than laying down. It's central, and there is tenderness in the middle of the back. Sometimes this involves compression of the nerves, and sometimes compression of the spinal cord up higher in the spine, and it can also be associated with instability. The back holds us up. If the back is structurally unable to hold us up, that is, of course, an issue. The best treatment for fractures is prevention. So this is kind of broken into two segments again. Wear your seatbelt. It does reduce fractures if you're in an automobile collision. But more importantly than that, if you have a fracture associated with a car accident, you're 17 times less likely to have neurologic injury if you're wearing your seatbelt than if you were not wearing your seatbelt. For osteoporosis prevention, we all know that doing what this lady is doing, but not necessarily to quite the degree, is the right treatment. This is an Australian grandmaster bodybuilding champion in the female division. She's lifting about 2.5 times her body weight, which I do not recommend. But some light weight-bearing exercise, especially in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and as you get older, but the sooner it starts and becomes a habit, the better off you will be. Of course, there are medications to treat osteoporosis. The discussion about those medicines is well beyond what we could talk about today. Some of them are double-edged swords where they will prevent fractures, they reduce the number of fractures, but then if you have a fracture, they prevent healing of the fracture, so that's something to know about. And then there are some newer medications that can actually help people with severe osteoporosis lay down more bone. That usually is a discussion with a primary care physician, sometimes with a rheumatologist, and then making sure that we get adequate calcium and vitamin D. As a society, we don't spend enough time outside, so vitamin D supplementation is an important issue for, and this is mostly for younger people. If we can lay down good bone, especially young women lay down good bone in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, they will end up with much better back health later in their lives. Fracture treatment sometimes requires surgery, sometimes it does not require surgery. If there is neurologic injury or structural instability, that's when I have to do this. Put rods and screws in you, decompress the bones, stabilize everything, get you back into alignment. And obviously, that That's something that all of us would like to avoid if possible. If we're neurologically and structurally stable and we have a compression fracture, so this is the little old lady who was fluffing her pillow and broke her back. Well, the right way to treat that is with bracing, give her a little bit of support. The pain medicines, anti-inflammatories, every once in a while some narcotics here, because again, this is a pain I expect to go away. Calcitonin, it's a little nasal spray that can be used to help the body heal the bone. It also does tend to reduce the pain. Activity modification for the short term. And that bottom area there, bottom word is kyphoplasty, and that's putting cement in the bone. This is a little bit of a difficult issue because this usually happens to older people. And the Medicare rules about doing kyphoplasty put us in a very tight window. It's almost a catch-22. Kyphoplasty does help with pain. It helps pain go away quicker, but this pain usually goes away after about 2 to 3 months on its own. And Medicare doesn't want to pay for something that is going to get better on its own, and that's appropriate. And so what they say is they want us to do all of this stuff. They want us to do all of this stuff for 6 weeks before we consider doing the surgery. But if it's been more than 3 months, the surgery is no longer indicated because the pain is probably coming from somewhere else because the bone is healed. So there really is only a very tight window when kyphoplasty can be considered, because usually people are about 4 weeks into their injury before they end up getting to a neurosurgeon. So they've usually had a couple of the other treatments, but not all of them. Start them on the treatments, they get 6 weeks of that, and then reassess them. Most of the time, the pain has actually started to go away by then, and we don't need to be considering a kyphoplasty. But if they're continuing to have pain, that actually leaves us with about 2 weeks where I can get them in to see me, get them scheduled for surgery, get surgery approved, and get it done before Medicare says that it's not an indicated procedure. That takes us to what can be the result of a fracture, which is imbalance in the spine. Now, the majority of imbalance in the spine that I see is of this variety. It's a degenerative scoliotic spine. The spine doesn't always settle. Arthritis is not always symmetric, and it makes the spine curve just slightly. That's what's happened here. In this other picture, this is a much more substantial scoliotic deformity. And what you'll notice is here, the top of the scoliotic deformity is relatively well centered over the pelvis. But here, this person's head is sitting way over here and their pelvis is way over here. And they cannot be balanced correctly. And that does cause a significant amount of muscular pain. This is usually something that is taken care of by specific orthopedic spine surgeons that deal with scoliotic deformity. I don't do this myself. Every once in a while, I'll see somebody like this, and it's just not generally dealt with by neurosurgeons. This is treatable, but we have to be careful with it so it doesn't turn into this. And usually, we don't treat a scoliotic deformity. We treat the result of the scoliotic deformity, the nerve compression. Another form of deformity, and this is what would more typically happen after a fracture, is a kyphotic deformity. What kyphosis means is that you're bent forward like this. So lordosis is the normal backwards curve that we get in the spine. This would be the person's belly button. This would be the back of their back here. And a nice normal curve, again, puts the base of the neck directly over the sacrum here, the pelvis. If we lose that nice normal curve, either because the discs degenerate, wear out, and flatten down, or because we get a fracture in one of these bones and it tips us forward, and the neck ends up significantly forward, meaning the center of gravity is anterior, that puts a huge amount of strain on the muscles back here. It's a big lever. We're held up kind of like a seesaw. The muscles in the back balance our center of gravity, which is slightly forward in a normal person. Now, this person has their center of gravity significantly forward, and that's going to cause those muscles to work about 5 times harder, because the difference between the fulcrum here and the fulcrum here is nothing. The difference between the fulcrum here and the fulcrum here is a huge amount. So that's a problem with spinal deformity. It's also a problem with body habitus. Body habitus, what size we are. If we carry our weight out front, like most of us do, if we have excess weight, that also puts our center of gravity forward. For every 5 pounds that we have out front, it's probably about 35 pounds that our back sees. So if you are 50 pounds overweight, your back is going to be seeing a couple hundred extra pounds of pressure at each level. So other sources of back pain, this is an uncommon one. Tumors or infection, I include it for completeness. If you have a history of cancer and you have significant back pain, you do need to be evaluated, especially if it's a new back pain, with an MRI, just to make sure that you don't have cancer in your spine. If you have risk factors for an infection, if you are immunocompromised, if you've had chemotherapy, you would be immunocompromised. If you have diabetes, if you've recently had an infection, that can take root in the discs. The disc doesn't get much blood supply, and so infections can kind of go crazy in that area, and they'll destroy the disc and can cause significant back pain. This is something that a physician really has to figure out more than anything else. And there will be clues in your history, if this is what you're dealing with, that tip the physician off. If you've had fevers, obviously you need to think more about an infection. If you've had a recent infection, think about the infection. The good news is, with these two problems, it's very treatable. It's very patient specific, but getting in there and cleaning out any infection or getting a piece of a tumor to tell what it is and then treating it works very, very well. And we have a lot of advances in technology, particularly with tumors and the cyber knife, and being able to focus radiation right down on the spine to kill a tumor in an area where it normally would grow, is really allowed us to treat these two problems very well. Again, they're not good things to have, but it's unusual for people to die of problems like this, and usually we can get the pain under very good control. Lumbar nerve compression. This is what everybody who comes to my office is worried that they have. This is what causes that pain that goes below the knee. The nerves that come out of the back go all the way down to the feet. The L3, L4, L5, and sacral 1 nerves all go all the way down past the knee and into the feet. Sometimes when people have compression of these nerves from a disc herniation or from a facet joint cyst or overgrowth of the facet joint, they only hurt in their leg. And they'll think that their physician is crazy for ordering an MRI and then sending them to a neurosurgeon to talk about their back when they're really having very little back pain. That's not always the case. And the majority of time, people do have both back and leg pain. The nerves, of course, give sensation. So sometimes there's numbness, sometimes there's weakness. And I can usually tell about what kind of problem you have if you have this type of pain by what position hurts more. Sometimes it's standing hurts more, sometimes sitting hurts more. And in general, this hurts more than the back pain that you've been dealing with. So a lot of times this comes from that degenerative change, and people will say, yeah, I've had back pain for 30 years, but it's nothing like what I'm experiencing now that's shooting down my leg. And because it does involve the nerves, the treatment is often, but not always, surgical. So the non-surgical treatment, y'all have heard this before, anti-inflammatories, usually regular exercise with a disc herniation that's not necessarily the truth, and sometimes it's activity modification instead. Weight loss, you've heard it before, you'll hear it again. The physical therapy, chiropractic care and traction, again, smoking cessation, and then this new one is injections. Steroid injections into the low back do help with the inflammation around the nerves, and they can very much help the pain that people who have nerve compression syndromes are dealing with. So this is a lumbar disc herniation. What's happened here is that hard outer ring is no longer containing the soft, juicy center of the disc called the nucleus pulposus, and then that cushion has squirted out and is pressing on the nerve here as it tries to escape the spinal canal. You can see it here from the side. Again, chunk of disc pressing on the nerve. And here's an actual MRI. This is a normal, healthy disc. You can see the hard outer ring, where a person is kind of sliced like a banana long ways here. So this is their spinal canal. And the nerves are sitting in this white spinal fluid. But at this level, the disc has squirted out. The nucleus pulposus has squirted out. And there's even a chunk of free disc that's no longer at all contained by the annulus there that is sitting out in the spinal canal. This is usually a sudden onset of pain. Most people don't know exactly what they did to cause the disc herniation. Sometimes people will wake up from sleep with it. That's actually not an uncommon way to present. Usually people will say they did something a little bit too much the day before, and then they woke up the next morning and their leg was killing them. This is a problem of younger people because younger people have more padding. They've had less time for the degeneration that happens and less time for the discs to wear out. Doesn't mean old people or older people can't get disc herniations. And I've seen them all the way up into 90-year-olds. But just in general, it's a problem of younger people. And if you have a disc herniation as a 90-year-old, usually it means you have a pretty healthy spine overall, and it's just given way in what happens to a 30-year-old typically. This one, sitting hurts. In a disc herniation, people will frequently come to my office, and I can tell it's a disc herniation when I walk in to see them because they're standing in the exam room and they won't sit down the whole time I talk to them. I even had a gentleman who had a disc herniation that he decided not to have operated on and became a chronic problem for him. And when I first saw him, he hadn't sat down for 8 years with horrible pain going down into his leg. And really, he would lay down, he would stand up, but he would not sit down. His leg pain's better now, but he's been so long since he sat down, he's still scared to sit, and so he still won't sit. So this should go down one leg. If it goes down both legs, if there's significant weakness, if there's bladder difficulty, especially if it's going down both legs or if there's bladder difficulty, that can actually become more of an emergency because it's pressing on all the nerves, not just one of the nerves. It's pressing on all the nerves in the low back, and that can cause permanent bladder difficulty if not treated quickly. So if you're having what's called cauda equina syndrome, if a surgeon tells you that they feel like you have cauda equina syndrome, that really is something that does need treated on a very urgent basis. You really don't even need to go home if that's what you got. You get admitted straight to the hospital and you get operated on. If the pain is not severe, and it is a spectrum, sometimes people say, you know, it doesn't bother me too much. If the pain is not horrible and it can be managed with an injection and the anti-inflammatory medications and the activity modification, the pain usually gets better after about 6 to 12 months. That chunk of soft disc will resorb. The body just absorbs it. It goes away over about that 9-month period of time. Now, that doesn't always happen, and sometimes it will form a chronic disc herniation, but very frequently the pain does go away. The disc herniation does go away on its own. Still, the majority of people who present with bad disc herniations end up having surgery because surgery is the best way to get rid of the pain the quickest. And if they have weakness, it's the most likely way to preserve their neurologic function. Lumbar stenosis is like a disc herniation, but tends to happen to older folks. This is a degenerative process, not an acute process, so it comes on slowly. And what's happened here, what happens with lumbar stenosis is the disc itself starts to wear out, loses some of that soft inner center, and the annulus here starts to buckle back into the nerves. And in addition to that, the facet joints, the other two joints that are in the back, they take more of the load and they build up arthritis. And the arthritic change in your fingers causes some soreness in your fingers, but there are no nerves that run between your knuckles. Here, there are nerves that run between the knuckles, so when the knuckles start to press on each other, they're pinching the nerves. Somebody with lumbar stenosis hurts more when they stand than when they sit. This is the person who, doesn't matter what they're getting at the grocery store, they get a grocery cart so that they can lean over on it, because leaning over on it opens up the spinal canal and helps those nerves just have just a millimeter more of room to let them stand up. If they can't have a shopping cart, they'll just walk around like this. And if they stand up for any significant length of time, they are immediately looking for a chair to sit in. This is a person who can't go to the DMV because standing in a line for 2 or 3 hours just isn't an option. They can't stand there that long. Pain that bothers these people usually goes down both legs. It's not just one leg. And that's because the arthritis usually forms symmetrically or relatively symmetrically. One is usually worse than the other, but in reality, it is both. You can see here what's happened to this person. This is a normal spinal canal. You have a nerve here, you have a nerve here. These are little nerve rootlets that are sitting in the spinal fluid. And this is a stenotic spinal canal. The disc has started to buckle back into the nerve some, and that facet joint here has become overgrown. This is a facet joint on this picture here, and see how much bigger it is here, and it started to pinch all those nerves. The nerve root should be sitting here, nerve root should be sitting here, you can't even see it, and then the spinal canal that was wide open is now very small. This tends to gradually get worse. It can be treated with injections to buy time, essentially. But as it gets worse, people usually end up having to have surgery to open it up. And the goal of the surgery is to go in here and trim away the facet joints and just give the nerves a little bit more room. Lumbar instability is a broad topic. And instability pain in the back is pain in the back that tends to be kind of a sharp stabbing pain with twisting or turning. It's a little bit nonspecific. It goes along with some of the degenerative type pain. And pain that's in the back and only in the back, again, usually try and stay away from surgery. But if I do x-rays and somebody is bending forward and backwards and their bones clearly move abnormally, they will develop significant arthritis and almost always end up having to have something done to stabilize those bones, eliminate the arthritis that's pressing on nerves, and keep it from getting worse in the future. This is a specific type of instability called a spondylolisthesis. And what happens in a spondylolisthesis, there are two forms. This one is a degenerative spondylolisthesis from the facet disease. The facets just wear out and they don't hold the bones in place any longer. One of the roles there is to hold the bones in place, and that allows this bone to slip forward on this bone. The bone itself is intact, but it is the incompetency in those facet joints that becomes a problem. The other form of a spondylolisthesis is where this part of the bone here, something called the pars interarticularis, but it's the bridge of bone that holds the facet joint onto the rest of the bone, breaks. It's a stress fracture in the back. People don't know when they broke their back. This is just something that happened with time. And this stress fracture in the back has disconnected one of the support structures, and so it allows the bone to shift forward. This problem tends to get worse with time, and is something that almost always requires surgery. If we look at people who do have and it's a fusion operation to fix it, but if we look at the people who have surgery, they usually get somewhat better, especially if they're already experiencing leg pain. They'll get better, but the people who don't have surgery will gradually get worse. And the further out we follow people who have this problem, the wider the gap between people who had surgery and didn't have surgery becomes. So how do I do the majority of the surgery I do? I do as much as I can through a minimally invasive approach. It's just a fancy way of getting to the spine. The majority of the work is the same, but getting there without disrupting the surrounding tissues allows some significant advantages. Make a small incision, I dilate little tubes through the muscle so I don't have to cut the muscle off the bone, it doesn't kill the muscle, and gives me good access so I can go in there, I can take that disc herniation out, or I can trim away the stenosis. I can even do those fusion operations through a minimally invasive approach. It involves a couple more incisions because I have to put rods and screws in, but I can do that under x-ray guidance. The advantages of doing it this way: it maintains more stability, especially in that scoliotic spine that we saw earlier, the degenerative scoliosis. If I go in there, I open it up and take the majority of the back part of the spinal column out, they're more likely to develop more instability and gradual worsening of their difficulty. But if I do it through a small approach and leave most of that structure in place, leave most of the muscle in place and most of the muscular attachments in place, that doesn't happen as frequently. Sometimes I can actually see better. I'm operating through that little tube and I use a microscope. Sometimes I can actually see better to decompress the nerves than I can with a traditional open approach, and that just has to do with angles of surgery. People get better faster. Even doing fusion operations, people are out of the hospital usually after a day. And this is actually the surprise benefit that we got from a conversion to minimally invasive surgery, is an incredibly low infection rate. It seems to have something to do with the fact that there's nowhere for the infection to set up, and because I'm operating through a tube, I'm not taking instruments past the skin very frequently. But I've been in practice since 2010. I've done hundreds of cases minimally invasively like this, and I've never had to take a patient back to the operating room for an infection. Anybody who's known somebody who had a staph infection or dealt with a staph infection, that's a big deal. It's something that, because of where an incision is on your low back, had been a big problem with lumbar surgery, especially lumbar fusion operations and even disc operations. It's something that we may have really found a solution to. So I know I didn't talk anything about necks. I'm happy to answer any questions about neck pain. It falls along similar lines. Pain down the arm tends to be more something that can be treated. Pain that stays in your neck, all the same thing that we talked about for low back difficulty, helps with the neck as well. I'd be happy to answer any questions.